This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Yeah, welcome back to the third hour of our program. And I want to get into, just share with you a little interaction that Kamala Harris and Judge Brett Kavanaugh had yesterday. This has to do with the Mueller investigation. Going back to the, what was that? Oh, okay. Going back to the theory that, the reason why Donald Trump added Brett Kavanaugh to the list of people the Federalist Society had given him, which in and of itself is obscene, right? That we're outsourcing to nonprofits that are funded by billionaires and corporations the job of picking a Supreme Court justice. But the Federalist Society came up with the list, and then Donald Trump added Brett Kavanaugh to that list. After Brett Kavanaugh's friends got into the media, that Brett Kavanaugh thought that a president can't be questioned even, much less indicted for a crime. Okay. So the question then is there essentially a conspiracy here between people in the Trump organization or people close to or affiliated with the Trump organization? And by organization, I don't mean just, you know, the Trump companies, but also the administration. In fact, I should probably say administration. Is there a conspiracy between the administration and Brett Kavanaugh to explicitly and specifically get him on the court so that he can lobby against any effort by a grand jury or by Robert Mueller to submit a subpoena to Donald Trump for testimony, for papers, or for anything else that might lead to his impeachment or his indictment, and that would also block an indictment? So that's the question. Is there a conspiracy here? Before the hearing, before the appointment, was Brett Kavanaugh talking to these people, particularly to the people affiliated with the law firm that represents Donald Trump and Steve Bannon? Well, I don't know if they represent Steve Bannon. That's the guy who's vetting the paperwork for the Senate committee right now. He represents Steve Bannon. But the law firm that represented Donald Trump, is that law firm participating in a conspiracy with Kavanaugh? I mean, that's the, if she doesn't come right out and say it, but this is what's implicit in this line of questioning coming from Senator Kamala Harris yesterday. Just listen to this and check this out. It's about 2 minutes. We're not hearing the audio. So, okay, we're just gonna have to pause that for a little while, and let's pick up some phone calls here. George in Chicago. Hey, George, what's on your mind today?
Oh, thanks for taking my call, Tom. with respect, and I have the highest respect for you and your staff and all you do, I'd like to disagree somewhat with your characterization of what's happening in the White House and the op-ed as a coup d'etat.
Okay.
My high school French is pretty rusty, but as I recall, the French term refers to the lopping off of heads. And so far, there hasn't been any violence or armed men invading the White House or the president or the vice president being forcibly removed from office.
Well, I don't think there's been a guillotine used in a coup since the French Revolution. So the use of the term has evolved over the years.
I understand,
George.
But what I'm getting at is I think it's more correct to characterize what's happening as insubordination, and it's not risen to the level of what I would consider a coup. We're stuck with a governmental system that was invented in the 1700s, and it's flawed. And we don't have a real self-correcting mechanism for a president who came to office the way Trump did, and for an individual who is as flawed and unbalanced as Trump is. And
we actually do. It's the 25th Amendment.
Out with ways to try and deal with this, but I wouldn't call it a coup.
We actually do have a mechanism for that. It's the 25th Amendment, and if whoever wrote this op-ed had any courage at all, they would be A, public, and B, calling on members of the cabinet and the vice president to initiate proceedings under the 25th Amendment.
Well, I can't really disagree with that point, but What I'm saying is that the 25th, well, in particular about the 25th Amendment, if my memory of its text is correct, that even if the cabinet meets and certifies that the president is not fit for office, all the president has to do is address a letter, I believe, to the Secretary of State and to the President pro tem of the Senate and the Speaker of the House, or
right,
something similar,
asserting his,
say,
his fitness.
I'm fine, and I'm back in business, and that's all he has to do to get back in the saddle.
Well, there are these series of 21-day loops, but you know, ultimately, it comes down to a vote. I believe I need to go back and reread the 25th Amendment, but I want to get back to the original point that you're making here, George, and you know, my take on this is that we have a group inside the White House who are basically suborning, or who are, no, that's the wrong word, who are disrupting or blocking the efforts of the president to accomplish what he wants. And if that had been happening to Barack Obama, we would be flipped out.
But Barack Obama was legitimately and substantially, by solid margins, elected twice to the office. You can't say that about Trump.
I don't disagree, broadly speaking, but I don't think that's an excuse. And let me take this to the second level, which is where, you know, I go from being upset to being very, very concerned. And that is the Reichstaggebüge fire. Theory, which is that whether this was intentional, whether this letter was published by partisans on Trump's side, maybe even without Trump's knowledge, to try to bring things to a head, or whether this was unintentional, the consequence of it may well be that a massive purge begins to take place in the executive branch, and the fallout from that may be a wildly, newly empowered, extremely radical right-wing administration that takes no prisoners at all, that sees enemies everywhere, including in Congress and including in the courts. And we get back to the Abe Lincoln with the Dred Scott or Andrew Jackson with the Trail of Tears scenario, where they just start saying, you know, I don't care what the courts say, I'm not going to follow the law. I don't care what the legislature said, I'm not going to follow the law. And, well, in the case of Abe Lincoln, of course, he had the Civil War, but he suspended habeas corpus. You know, I wouldn't put any of that past Trump. He has so little knowledge of the history of this country and the founding principles and ideals, and he has no principles of his own other than me, mine. And I'm concerned that this is handing him a blowtorch, basically, to go after people in his own administration.
Well, let us hope that something that, with the import of that, is so terrible that it doesn't happen.
Yeah, let us hope.
One aside about who actually wrote this, Chris Matthews on his MSNBC show, Hard Talk, said,
Hardball,
based on his experience in the Capitol, he deduced that it was Dan Coats, the National Intelligence Director. And I would think that makes sense in terms of a connection with Pence, because they're both from Indiana. This way, Pence's fingerprints are off it, but a fellow Indianan, and who knows, there may be a Hoosier Mafia at work here.
Yeah.
They may be behind it.
Boy, that makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense. Because my first instinct was to think, okay, this is Mike Pence. And, you know, but obviously he's going to have to get somebody to do it as his agent. He's going to have a front man. And Dan Coats makes a lot of sense, the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence. George, thanks for the call. You know, I think our disagreements are fairly minor on this. You may object to my use of the word coup, but I don't know a better word. Well, you think it's insubordination. Insubordination typically is known, but we're splitting hairs here around the semantics of it all. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Just a bit past 15 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with more of your calls and the news of the day in just a moment. Mr. Pierce, writing over at Esquire, fascinating. Please stick around. Welcome back. Tammy, watching YouTube in Kennesaw. Is that Kennesaw, Georgia?
Yes.
I have been there. I used to live right down the road from Kennesaw. What's up, Tammy?
Yes, I know. Well, one thing I wanted to say is that for the first time since 1972, we have two Democrats on the ticket in Kennesaw.
Cool.
And I met one of them. Yes, I'm very excited about that. And also, they also warned me that Georgia voters need to make sure that their registration, their voter's registration is intact, because Kemp, one of the guys, the Republican guy running for governor here,
yep, Brian Kemp,
was taking people off the registry.
Oh, he purged 400,000 Georgians off the voter rolls over the last 2 years in anticipation of his run for governor, because he was the Secretary of State, or is the Secretary of State. So, in fact, the New York Times wrote a brilliant op-ed. the New York Times had a brilliant op-ed titled "Brian Kemp, Enemy of Democracy," which if people don't know about, they should look up, and anybody, any Georgian should be looking at that. Tammy, quick question. Are you still required by law in Kennesaw, Georgia, to own a gun?
It is a law, but it's a law that they cannot
enforce.
Enforce, yes. So it's kind of a lame duck law, but, you know, people all over here have signs and on their front doors and in their windows say, "There's nothing in my house worth dying for," and they have their guns, you know, whatever.
Right.
But I had a quick question for you.
Okay.
What would happen if the Democrats just didn't show up to the rest of the Brett Kavanaugh hearing?
There would be no hard questions asked. There would be no statements made that might cause Susan Collins or Lisa Murkowski or others, you know, if there are any Republicans with integrity left in the Senate. I guess the two that are trying to position themselves in that category are Jeff Flake and Bob Corker. And if Flake and Corker actually had any integrity, they would start caucusing with the Democrats today. But, you know, hopefully, you know, the hope that the Democrats have is that, A, they can expose to the American people what a charade this is, and B, by playing the role of a loyal opposition, and B, uncover enough of the truth about Brett Kavanaugh that he'll become sufficiently radioactive that he won't get elected, that he won't get, his nomination will not be ratified by the Senate.
I don't know. What about, could they dump all the papers that they do have and say, calling all lawyers?
They're doing that right now. That's what Cory Booker proclaimed this morning when he said, you know, we're just going to, even if you throw me out of the Senate, I'm going to break the rules and disclose these documents. The senator from Hawaii, is her last name Mazzeo? I think Haroni Mazzeo. In any case, she just published on Twitter. I just retweeted it, in fact. Documents about how Brett Kavanaugh was saying that basically that there should be nothing for native-born Hawaiians, that's racism to give native-born Hawaiians any kind of preference in Hawaii. Yeah, it's pretty bizarre stuff. Tammy, thank you for the call, and thanks for watching us in Kennesaw. It's great to hear from you. Brings back pleasant memories. It's 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with more right after this. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, helping you win the water cooler wars. Bill in Richmond, Virginia. Hey, Bill, what's up?
I'm just fine, Tom. The thing I assume your screener is this. As I watch this whole procedure going on, is that I'm watching something that's happened the last 5 or 6 years. This thing about breaking precedents, about doing something different. I know there's been complaint about the Supreme Court of being a simple majority, but that came about because of Harry Reid. And let's just go all the way through. Everything I'm seeing happen, what goes around comes around. And how long does this big circle keep going on?
I think that an economic crash is coming, and it's going to reboot the entire American political system.
So it would take something like the 1930s to make things.
If you look at the history of the United States, every single time there's been a major reboot, and even minor reboots, there was the great crash of 1897 that led directly to Teddy Roosevelt and the progressives and Taft, the Republican progressives. The great crash of 1856 led to the Civil War. The great crash of 1770 led to the American Revolution. The great crash of 1929 led to the New Deal. Every time that we've had a major reboot in this country, it's either been the result of a massive effort, a long, multi-generational effort, women's suffrage, the end of slavery, those kinds of things, or a massive economic crash. And typically the two have come together. And the crash has provided the basis for activism that brings about the social change. So that's my opinion. Well, and I wrote an entire book about this, Bill, called The Crash of 2016. Obviously, the economy didn't crash.
Wasn't the same thing happened in Germany, did it? Isn't that the same way Hitler got in power?
Yeah, it was the Great Depression that brought Hitler to power in large part. It was also the Treaty of Versailles just wiped out Germany. What's the guy's name who was the financial advisor? John Maynard Keynes to FDR. John Maynard Keynes, when the Treaty of Versailles was signed, wrote an op-ed, I believe it was in the New York Times, in which he said that if this treaty is signed, it will guarantee World War II. Now, this was in like 1920. And the reason why he said that was because the Treaty of Versailles basically said that Germany had to pay back France and it had to pay back all the countries that Germany had invaded in World War I, had to pay them full reparations and restore their countries. And when Hitler came into power, Germany was so crushed by this. Actually, it wasn't even Hitler, it was Bismarck before that. Germany was so crushed by this that in order to pay off these bills, because the bills were denominated in Deutschmarks, they said, okay, Germany, you owe us. You owe France a trillion Deutschmarks. You owe Poland, 500 billion Deutschmarks or whatever. So what they did is they inflated their currency to the point that a trillion Deutschmarks was enough to buy a loaf of bread. But that then set the stage, that absolute devastation of the German economy, which came about because of the Treaty of Versailles and was compounded by the Great Depression, which was affecting Europe just like it was us in the 1930s. That set the stage for 1933 and Hitler. And all he needed was an inciting incident. All he needed was some big, flashy thing to happen that would cause Germans to think that the Republic was under attack and they would rally around him. And when the Nazis helped the Reichstaggebäude, the Reichstag building, the German parliament building, there was an office building, sort of like the right now you've got the executive office building that's down the street from the White House, but there's an underground tunnel that connects them. There was this underground tunnel, and the Nazis took Marius van der Lubbe, was this 23-year-old Dutch guy who was mentally retarded and perhaps mentally ill. And they smuggled him down through that tunnel into the Reichstag building and carried the gasoline or kerosene or whatever they used and poured it on the tapestries. At that time, the Reichstag building had these huge, ancient, 16th, 17th, 18th century tapestries lining the walls of the main corridors. And they poured this gasoline on these things and lit it on fire. And as soon as the news came that the Reichstag was on fire, Hitler was having lunch with von Papen at the time. And he rushed over to the Reichstag building, contacted the news media. The radio reporters and the newspaper reporters with their cameras met Hitler there, and Hitler on a microphone, on a live microphone for all of German radio, said, "This fire is a sign from God, von Gott."
I understand what you're saying because I'm a history major.
My concern is that we might, but this coup that's happening in the White House might be Donald Trump's Reichstag fire.
Well, the one difference, though, this is the one thing, and any historian would probably say this, particularly this country the size it is now, with 300 and some odd million people, you can't go back in history and find a time that much of a population, and this is the problem we have, the good, bad of it. There is no homogenous United States. So I just cannot believe that you'd have to have so many things fall into place. And really, I would prefer not to have a major economic crash to sit through and make a course correction.
Yeah, I don't think that you need that many things, Bill. And I'll give you an example from our own recent history. In the summer of 2001, if I had gone on the radio and said, I predict within 1 year we are going to invade a country that has done absolutely nothing to hurt or harm us and that represents no threat to us whatsoever, and we're going to invade that country, and we're going to spend over $1 trillion, and we're going to be there for the next 20 years. You would have said, Tom, you're crazy. And then 9/11 happened, and George Bush used that, the same way Hitler used the Reichstag fire, as a national alarm bell and said, because of 9/11, we have to invade both Afghanistan and Iraq, even though Iraq had absolutely nothing to do with it, and Bush knew it. And so, no, I don't think it's that hard, frankly, to fool the American people into something really insane, because it has been done by George W. Bush.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
And God forbid it's being done right now by Donald Trump or by partisans or billionaires acting on his behalf. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I've got just this amazing thing from the New York Times. It's remarkable. The headline, Why Was Kavanaugh Obsessed with Vince Foster? Remember Vince Foster back in 1993? Vince Foster was a guy who worked in the White House. He was suffering from severe clinical depression, which was well documented by his doctors. And he went out and shot himself in the head, committed suicide. They found his body, and you know that was the end of that. Until the Alex Joneses of the right got a hold of it and said, oh no, he was murdered by Hillary Clinton. We all know it. And somebody went to Ken Starr, who had investigated this in 1997. Now, this is 5 years later, right? Four years later. In 1997, Ken Starr investigated the death of Vince Foster and concluded that it was a suicide. And somebody went to Ken Starr and said, why don't we get hair follicle samples from Vince Foster's daughter so we can find out what was really going on? Let's open a full-fledged investigation. We have reliable sources on this. Reading from the article. But shortly after the Senate report, this is the Senate report saying, you know, Ken Starr killed himself. He was suffering from depression. Shortly after the Senate report was released, Mr. Kavanaugh convinced Mr. Starr to reopen what he called a full-fledged investigation of this Foster matter, telling his colleagues his justification that, quote, this is Brett Kavanaugh speaking, we have received allegations that Mr. Foster's death related to President and Mrs. Clinton's involvement, end quote, in Whitewater and other scandals. And who were those unnamed, presumably reliable sources that Brett Kavanaugh was quoting? Yeah, it was the Jerome Corsis of the world. It was the right-wing crazies. This guy has been, you know, yesterday I said, and somebody called me up and said, how dare you say that? Sonia Sotomayor was out as a Democrat. I said, you know, Brett Kavanaugh has been a right-wing hitman. He's been a Republican operative for years. He worked in the Bush White House. He helped coordinate the lawsuit in 2000, Bush v. Gore, where George Bush claimed before the Supreme Court that he would suffer irreparable harm if the vote in Florida was recounted. And in fact, we learned later he would have. He would have lost the White House because Al Gore actually won in Florida. Brett Kavanaugh was in on that. He was part of that. This guy's been a Republican hitman forever. Anyhow, let's pick up your calls. Paul in Woodinville. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Well, Tom, you were talking about a conspiracy with regard to this Brett Kavanaugh nomination. I think there's a conspiracy that goes back to the death of Antonin Scalia. I'm not talking about his death, but the stonewalling of Merrick Garland.
Yeah.
If you look at this, what sense does that make? And look at the timing, February 2016. At that point, Mitch McConnell, everyone pretty well knew that Donald Trump was going to be the nominee for the Republican Party. So if you're looking at Merrick Garland as the nominee for the Supreme Court, unless you knew something, and I think Mitch McConnell and many in the Republican Party did know that there was collusion and interference by Russia, why wouldn't you just pick, at least give Merrick Garland a hearing and say, I'm sorry, there are too many reasons. And the reason they didn't say that is because there was no reason. They didn't give him a hearing because they had no good reason to say no.
This is why Barack Obama picked Merrick Garland, is because he went to Orrin Hatch, who is on the Senate committee here, and we've been hearing from him for a couple of days. He went to Orrin Hatch and said, give me the name of a republic of a judge who is acceptable to the Republicans, the non-controversial. He wanted to have...
Well, why would you at that time, if you're Mitch McConnell, say we're going to wait for the election, especially if you thought Hillary Clinton was presumed winner, worse yet for their part of view, Bernie Sanders, who would nominate somebody much more liberal.
Right. So you're thinking that Mitch McConnell knew that the fix was in.
Yes, he knew he had odds to win the White House. And so he was playing, he was playing the dice. He was playing the odds. And he knew there was even odds because he knew the fix was in.
The fix being what? Voter suppression?
Sure, they've been playing this. This is a conspiracy. And let me add something else to this. They, you know, the Donald Trump, and this is a witch hunt, there's this, you know, there's kind of a phenomenon in social psychology that you tend to believe that other people are motivated the same way you are.
Sure.
So, of course, the Republicans think this is a witch hunt because that's the way they employ a special counsel, to do a witch hunt. But Robert Mueller, if there was nothing there by now, he'd say, I'm sorry, folks, there's nothing there.
Fine.
But he's come up with not only guilty pleas, but indictments that have led to convictions, there's something there. There's a there, as they like to say in Washington, D.C. And the there is, I think, there's a huge conspiracy here and that for collusion and...
So the big question, Paul, then, is did Mitch McConnell know that the fix was in and the extent to which the fix was in? Keep in mind, in Wisconsin, I believe it was over 200,000 or 150,000 people were purged from the voting rolls just before the election. In Ohio, it was over 200,000. In Michigan, it was in the neighborhood of 200,000. In Pennsylvania, it was a couple hundred thousand. Did Mitch McConnell, and was that the fix that Mitch McConnell knew about? Or did it have to do with electronic voting machines? Or did it have to do with something else? I mean, you know, what exactly was the fix that was in that McConnell knew about? Or was it Russian collusion?
That's what I think Robert Mueller will be able to tell us. But he knew his back was against the wall. If you were expecting to lose the election,
why would you burn that much political capital?
Right. A bird in hand. Merrick Garland was a bird in hand. You don't wait to see who Hillary Clinton or possibly Bernie Sanders would nominate.
Yeah, I agree with you, Paul. I agree. Thank you for the call. And the question is, you know, why would he burn through that much political capital? Why would Mitch McConnell get a huge black eye for doing something that had never been done when Hillary Clinton would come along as president and nominate somebody even more progressive than Merrick Garland? Because Merrick Garland was not a progressive. He was not even a Democrat. He was a Republican. So, anyhow, good questions all. Daryl in Denville, New Jersey. Hey, Daryl, what's up?
Hey, how are you?
Good. What's on your mind?
A couple of things. The first is, I think it was D&I Coates that wrote that op-ed.
It appears to be Chris Matthews' theory, too.
Yeah, I think he was pissed when he's blindsided about this with this invite to Russia to visit, or to Putin to visit the White House, and also the fact that he was never debriefed about what Trump told Putin during that two-hour meeting. I think that pissed him off. Also, I think that...
That makes a lot of sense.
And maybe... He and maybe Mattis and probably are the two that want to maybe preserve what appears to be a good reputation without repudiating Trump's agenda. So they're basically saying Trump's agenda is good, but Trump is not. And so this is a way for them to sort of like split the baby into two, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about this.
We just lost our caller. Bill, in Negotia, Indiana? No.
I'm Bill from Sunrise Beach, but I'm in Goshen, Indiana, picking up a trailer.
Oh, in Goshen. Okay, cool. What's up?
Yeah. So I think what we're in also is what Star Trek would call a political Kobayashi Maru.
Okay.
We as outsiders are in a no-win scenario.
I don't know what that means. Tell me.
The Kobayashi Maru was a no-win scenario test that you will fail, but it's a test of character. There's no way out. No matter what you do, The test is designed to make you fail.
Okay.
So there's no win. And that's what I feel we are in when you look at Trump-Pence.
Well, in that case, this morning, when Cory Booker stood up and said, you can kick me out of the Senate if you want, I'm going to break the rules and release these documents, he passed the character test.
In that sense, but what does it matter who's in charge ultimately? We got what's going on now. Trump's in charge. He's being called out, and Melania says, watch out, there's consequences.
Right.
If Kavanaugh gets confirmed before the election, there's the no-win scenario. Then Trump, if Pence takes Trump's case, he can do whatever Trump was going to do and say, I pardon myself. Kavanaugh goes along with that or goes along with Trump.
Yeah. Now, if Pence becomes president, he's going to pull a Jerry Ford. I absolutely predict that. He's going to pardon Donald Trump. Excellent point and excellent questions, Bill, the whole thing. Thank you very much for the call. And thanks for listening on our app out there, the Tom Hartman app. It is 16 minutes before the hour. We'll be back with more of your calls and the news of the day. This thing with Kavanaugh that just came out in the New York Times today, this is bizarre. That he sent investigators in search of follicle specimens from Vince Foster's teenage daughter? Really? We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
There's something very, very weird about Brett Kavanaugh. Just very, very weird. Stick around. And welcome back. John in Sebring, Florida. Hey, John, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
You're talking about having only one senator show up and then object to anything the other side wanted to do.
Right, for the record,
My question is, if no senators from our side showed up, wouldn't that be like a quorum call thing, that there has to be a certain number from each side?
Yeah, but a quorum for the U.S. Senate is 51 members, and they have 51 members right now.
But the rule doesn't say there has to be a certain number from each party?
No, just a simple majority.
That's terrible.
Yeah.
Can I throw one other quick thing out?
Sure.
You were talking about HARP a few days back. The HARP.
Oh, you're talking, yeah.
The HARP array?
Yeah, the system for communicating with submarines, yeah.
Well, actually, it's patented, and the patent says that the specific purpose of it is to heat the ionosphere to manipulate the weather, and the HARP array uses as much power as a city.
Yeah, so it might use a lot of power. But and a city is a rather flexible definition. But I'm very skeptical that there is such a patent, John.
It's patented.
Okay, all right. Well, I'll take your word for it. I'm not concerned about it, frankly. Thanks a lot for the call, Mike in Beaverton, Georgia. Hey, Mike, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Are you talking to me?
I am. You're on the air.
Oh, I'm in Beaverton, Oregon, actually.
Oh, Oregon. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It says Georgia here.
Yeah, I think I just want to note that I think one way we can trap Brett Kavanaugh is he keeps trying to rationalize he would overturn Roe v. Wade based upon not legislating from the bench. I think you could get him to confirm that's his rationale and then say, well, with that kind of rationale, wouldn't you also want to overturn Citizens United and Hobby Lobby? Because not only was that... decided by the bench, but it was decided by a court clerk's head note as a precedent for that law that, you know, was done back in Southern. You know about all that because you've written about it.
Right.
And I'm thinking you could trap him either to have to be consistent with his philosophy and saying, you upset his donors class by saying, okay, I would overturn them too, or he would expose himself as just being biased and against Roe v. Wade principally and not because of that rationale.
I think you're right in that he is going to, and the rest of the court is going to try and overturn Roe v. Wade, and they're going to do it by saying Roe v. Wade itself was legislation from the bench, so all we're doing is correcting an error that we made. Just like in Brown v. Board, we overturned Plessy versus Ferguson. Just like with the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments overturned Dred Scott, arguably. But I don't think that they would be receptive to an argument that Citizens United was the same thing, even though I agree with you that it was. I agree with the conservatives that Brown v. Board was legislation from the bench. It doesn't mean I'm opposed to the decision, but I think that, it was. And similarly, Citizens United, well, as you point out, Citizens United wasn't even brought forward as that kind of a case. It was a very small case that had to do with election law. And what was it, Rehnquist said to them, Roberts said to them, take it back and argue it on a much larger basis. So, yeah, I think that's definitely what they're going to do, Mike. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Well said. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. So, continuing with our conversations today, Alan in Windsor, Connecticut, watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, Alan, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I'd just like to say I think that it's a big payback on this op-ed from John McCain in his grave. Somebody that loves him is paying Trump back for the way he disrespected him.
I think that's entirely possible.
Yep, I truly think so. I hope so, because there was no call for the way he treated that man.
Yeah.
And I'm not a Republican, but I love what John McCain stood for.
Yeah, many of John McCain's ideals were noble. Many of them, many of the positions that he took were less than noble. But I get what you're saying, and he's being really substantially reinvented by the press in ways that are very positive. And it's an ideal that, you know, a lot of our mythology, a lot of our national mythologies aren't actually real. Our stories about George Washington and the cherry tree and all other kind of stuff. But, you know, this is a myth that's actually quite useful. Alan, I think that it's entirely possible that whoever wrote this started writing it on the day of McCain's funeral, because they mentioned McCain specifically in it. But, you know, if they're asserting that there is a cabal inside the administration that is subverting the will of the administration, that in my opinion, is a coup, and that, in my opinion, is a very dangerous thing. Alan, thank you for the call. Well said. Richard in Chicago, listening on Chicago's Progressive Talk. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Well, I was about this op-ed, and I just, I haven't known myself how to, deal with it. I got all worked up about it. I just don't think there's that much to this, and the reason, from a lot of standpoints, but one of them in particular is how many times are we going to have this final straw? And it's, and there's so many possibilities of the Kabuki Theater. Who knows who's behind this? It might be the cover-up for Kavanaugh. Who knows? At this point, and I don't feel it's a coup, by the way. I just think it's some administrative dampening of problems. But your points are well taken. I think in a week's time, we won't even remember the damn thing. Unfortunately,
we'll see. My concern is that Donald Trump takes this thing and uses it as an excuse to purge 10-20% of the staff out of the White House, and then starts going after the intelligence agencies, starts going after the Department of State, starts going after the Department of Commerce, and just basically department after department after department just purges everybody who does not agree with him and the Koch brothers.
I think he's been doing that already. I mean, from the
he has to a large extent, but not as vigorously.
But the whole thing is that, we need to think about it in terms of the congressional election, which is not the midterm election, but it's the congressional election.
That's correct.
And how this thing is useful for us, because we keep thinking that, that they're going to impose an impeachment. Well, the Republicans have already shown that they are contemptible. They're not Americans. They're illegitimate.
They're members of a money cult. A money-based cult.
Well, it's even worse. They're just, they just have their own interests, and they're just not going to ever act properly. So I'm sort of trying to step back from this. I got, pretty worked up about it. I think it's very interesting. But we just add another, it's another page in the book, and this SOB is going to be around a while more. And,
we'll see.
So anyway,
we'll
I think we should wait and find out who the heck, if we ever can find out more about it. It just bothers me. It seems like it's part of his.
Here's the thing, Richard. If Trump has the means to find out who wrote this, I mean, if nothing else, if he could get the cooperation of the FBI, he could find out who wrote it that way. He has the power to essentially even subpoena this. But if they don't reveal who wrote this in the next week or two, I'm beginning to think that the caller who called in earlier saying that he thinks that the author is actually Donald Trump himself, I don't think it's Donald Trump, it's somebody close to Trump. and that this was something that Trump could use to crack down on the kind of people in his administration who talked to Bob Woodward. I mean, basically, you're Donald Trump, you look around, you look at the Woodward book, and there's literally word-for-word verbatim quotes from John Kelly, from Mattis, from, I mean, you know, the whole list, right? And yeah. And you've got to be saying, who the hell talked to Bob Woodward? You can't go around and demand who talked to Bob Woodward. I mean, you can, but, you know, you may not get solid information, because that's not essentially a crime. But saying that you've taken over the executive branch of the federal government illegally, unethically, inappropriately, that is arguably a crime. That's the sort of thing that you can use this mechanism. And so I think it's possible, and I'm not willing to go full-bore conspiracy theory on this yet, but I think it's possible that this will work to the benefit of Donald Trump, whether that was his intention or not, or whether the intention of the people around him, in as much as it will allow him to do this giant purge. Richard, I got to move along. I want to get another call in here. Let's see, Stephen. I don't have a city for you, Stephen. Where are you calling from?
No, I'm actually traveling on the road, so I'm in Laredo, Texas, right now.
Okay, what's on your mind?
So I'm a conservative, and I've listened to your show many, as far as like at least for the last 3 years. I've listened to your show, and I've actually heard you be pretty reasonable. You know, when you articulate.
But we have just a minute here, Stephen, until the end of the program. So, get to it.
Okay, so I'm just surprised the amount of hysteria that's going around now. I'm really surprised that you guys are taking this for what it is. Why don't you guys push to get the anonymous source revealed?
I absolutely am.
No. I almost guarantee you that it's not going to be linked to Trump. This country has flipped its brain upside down.
Well, if it's not linked to Trump, Stephen, then we have a really serious problem.
Yeah, and Obama did it to reporters as far as you know.
Oh, he put James Risen in jail.
Back in the press. Yeah. So Trump hasn't done that. What I'm trying to get at is that people are not listening to, are not remembering what the things that happened in the past. And Trump's not even there yet.
Yeah.
It goes that way.
Well, we'll see. I mean, you know, if Trump can find that any of this has to do with national security, then he has the basis to go after this person the same way that Obama did Risen. And that I think, is also a dangerous precedent. What a day. So we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same bat place. And in the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It actually does require all of us. As Bernie used to say, as President Obama used to say, democracy is not a spectator sport. You have to get active. Make sure that your voter registration has not been purged by the Republicans. Get out there, get active, tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.